Welcome to Washington Today for Tuesday, November 29th, 2021. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. Here are some of today's headlines. The World Health Organization warned Monday that the global risk from the Omicron variant is, quote, very high, based on the early evidence, adding that the mutated coronavirus could lead to surges with, quote, severe consequences. The assessment from the UN Health Agency is the WHO's strongest, most explicit warning yet about the new version of COVID-19 that was first identified days ago by researchers in South Africa. Japan announced it would bar entry of all foreign visitors, joining Israel in doing the same. Morocco banned all incoming flights. Other countries, including the U.S. and members of the European Union, have moved to prohibit travelers arriving from South Africa. We'll have more on this in a moment with President Biden. A House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection has scheduled a vote Wednesday on whether to hold former Justice Department lawyer Jeffrey Clark in contempt of Congress. This is now the second time the committee is seeking criminal charges against a defiant witness. The committee first held former White House aide Stephen Bannon in contempt last month. Jeffrey Clark appeared for a deposition on November 5th, but told lawmakers that he would not answer questions based partly on Mr. Trump's legal efforts to block the committee's investigation. Mr. Clark had aligned with President Donald Trump in trying to overturn his defeat of the 2020 election. And Washington is waiting to see if Congress can pass a bill to fund the government and avert a partial shutdown before Friday deadline. Democrats have a list of priorities in the coming weeks as they try to avoid a shutdown, pass their $1.75 trillion Build Back Better bill, boost the debt limit, and approve a new defense budget bill. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned lawmakers that the government could exhaust its ability to pay the nation's bills as soon as December 15th. We'll have more on this with The Hill's Christina Marcos. We begin at the White House, Roosevelt Room, where President Joe Biden briefed reporters on the administration's response to the Omicron COVID-19 variant.
Today, there are three messages about the new variant that I want the American people to hear. First, this variant is a cause for concern, not a cause for panic. We have the best vaccine in the world, the best medicines, the best scientists, and we're learning more every single day. And we'll fight this variant with scientific and knowledgeable actions and speed, not chaos and confusion. We have more tools today to fight the variant than we've ever had before, from vaccines to boosters to vaccines for children, 5 years and older, and much more. A year ago, America was floundering against the first variant of COVID. We beat that variant significantly, and then we got hit by a far more powerful threat, the Delta variant. But we took action, and now we're seeing deaths from Delta come down. We'll fight the, you know, and look, we're going to fight and beat this new variant as well. We're learning more about this new variant every single day. And as we learn more, we're going to share that information with the American people candidly and promptly. Second, the best protection, I know you're tired of hearing me say this, the best protection against this new variant or any of the variants out there, the ones we've been dealing with already, is getting fully vaccinated and getting a booster shot. Most Americans are fully vaccinated, but not yet boosted. If you're 18 years or over and got fully vaccinated before June the 1st, go get the booster shot today. They're free, and they're available at 80,000 locations coast to coast. A fully vaccinated booster person is the most protected against COVID. Do not wait. Go get your booster if it's time for you to do so. And if you are not vaccinated, now's the time to get vaccinated and take your children to be vaccinated. Every child age 5 or older can get safe, effective vaccines now. While it will be a few weeks before we know everything we need to know about how strongly the existing vaccines protect against the new variant, Dr. Fauci is with me today, of our medical team, and believe that the vaccines will continue to provide a degree of protection against severe disease. And as additional protections, please wear your mask when you're indoors, in public settings, around other people. It protects you. It protects those around you. Third, in the event, hopefully unlikely, that updated vaccinations or boosters are needed to respond to this new variant, We will accelerate their development and deployment with every available tool.
The Omicron variant was first detected and reported in southern Africa. Over the weekend, President Biden restricted travel to the U.S. from Botswana, Zimbabwe, Namibia, Lesotho, Eswatini, Mozambique, and Malawi. Reporters asked President Biden about these travel restrictions.
Thank you so much, President Biden. Do you think that other countries will be reluctant to report variants or other strains given the travel ban that you put so quickly on South Africa?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that's what's going to happen. And I want to, again, the reason for the immediate travel ban is there were a significant number of cases, unlike any other country, well, there are few around South Africa in the world. We needed time to give people an opportunity to say, get that vaccination now before it heads. It's going to move around the world. I think it's almost inevitable there will be, at some point, that strain here in the United States. But I don't think anyone's going to be reluctant to report. We have also moved to do more. For example, we've provided more vaccines, as I said, than all other countries in the world combined. And we've provided significant vaccines as well to South Africa and that region. Matter of fact, South Africa doesn't need any more vaccine. They're having trouble getting it out in the people's arms, and the reluctance is there. But no, I don't think it's going to have that effect.
President Biden speaking from the White House Roosevelt Room earlier. The World Health Organization last Friday identified Omicron as, quote, a variant of concern. This is a label applied when a particular strain is especially virulent, transmissible, or able to defeat public health measures. The UK, EU, and US are among those who have imposed travel bans. The BBC's reporting that South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa said he is, quote, deeply disappointed by the travel ban, which he described as unjustified, and called for the ban to be urgently lifted.
This is a clear and completely unjustified departure from the commitment that many of these countries made at the meeting of the G20 countries in Rome last month. Now, these restrictions are completely unjustified and unfairly discriminate against our country and our Southern African sister countries. The prohibition of travel is not informed by science, nor will it be effective in preventing the spread of this variant. The only thing the prohibition on travel will do is to further damage the economies of the affected countries and undermine their ability to respond to and also to recover from the pandemic.
That's South African President Cyril Ramaphosa. Meanwhile, multiple experts have said they believe more will be known in the next couple of weeks about the Omicron variant's transmissibility and how vaccines respond to it. We hear now from Moderna CEO Stéphane Bancel.
Yes, and I think really this is the big question, Meg, is if you look at the new virus, it has the Delta mutation, it has the Beta mutation, and many more on the spike, up to 32 mutations. So we anticipate that there'll be a loss of vaccine efficacy to prevent disease. What is important for people to remember is that unlike an antibody treatment, vaccines provide you not one or two antibodies, but a soup of antibodies. And so some antibodies will still be protective, neutralizing antibodies, even if you have a mutation. And that's a piece that's really hard to handicap with what we did in the last few days to analyze the virus, you know, in silico on computers and doing, you know, 3D modeling and so on. It's tough to know, are we going to lose, you know, 5X, are we going to lose 8X of the antibody levels? This we really need to all be patient and see the data. Scientists have been working since middle of the next week before Thanksgiving weekend and working through the whole weekend. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, nonstop, because we don't know every day matters. What is important, I think, to know is that at Moderna, we have a free line of defense strategy. And I'm not aware of any company that has so many tools to help and respond if vaccine efficacy drops and or the virulence is higher or same. One is, as you know, we've lowered the dose of a booster of a current vaccine. And so we have a lot of safety data showing that we could go back to 100 microgram dose and to double the dose of a current vaccine, which should provide better protection than the third dose booster at 50 microgram. So that's first line of defense, actionable right away.
Speaking on CNBC, Moderna CEO Stefan Bancel. With more on what medical experts know about the Omicron COVID-19 variant, here's Dr. Amesh Adalja of Johns Hopkins University's Center for Health Security.
My initial thought is we have a lot of questions that need to be answered before we're able to really accurately understand the threat that Omicron poses. This is something that we have to take seriously, and it really underscores the need to be really adept at sequencing new variants and reporting them when they're discovered and really running them down to see how well our vaccines, how well our monoclonal antibodies, and how well and how more contagious something like this might be. But I think it's very early days, and there's a lot of noise in the early data that's going to take some time to sift through. But it is important that we answer these questions and understand what this means for the future of this pandemic.
Is it possible that vaccines that are currently being given, and the boosters especially that are being given, would be modified over time to deal with this variant and other variants?
One of the elegant features of mRNA vaccines is that they can be modified on the fly very easily. All you have to do is change the sequence of the spike protein that's in the mRNA. So this is something that companies have been doing with each new variant, making kind of a mock-up or understanding how quickly they could put together a new vaccine. So if there comes a time when you need to update the vaccine for the Omicron variant or for any other variant, this is something that can be done easily. But I think we're not quite at that threshold, because while the Omicron variant may contain some mutations that make it easier for it to get around some of the immunity that the vaccines have been able to induce, it's very, very unlikely that a variant can erase everything that a vaccine does for you. Meaning maybe you'll get a breakthrough infection at a higher frequency if exposed to the Omicron variant, but it's unlikely in a fully vaccinated healthy person that you would see serious disease, hospitalization, and death. And I think that's something that shows that the vaccines work at what matters most. But we have to really run this down and do those experiments and understand what's happening, and also marry that with clinical and epidemiological data from countries where this variant is present, trying to understand who's getting hospitalized. And the early data that we've seen from South Africa shows that this tends to be unvaccinated individuals getting hospitalized, which gives you some hint that the vaccine may be protecting against serious disease, which is a win for the vaccine.
Before the reporting on this variant, this is news from Gallup, one of their latest polls. U.S. adults' COVID-19 vaccinations are steady. Teen jabs pick up, and they say that 74% of U.S. adults are vaccinated against COVID-19. That's more than the early herd immunity thresholds, is it not? If that's the case, what would so-called herd immunity do?
Herd immunity is something I think that was kind of the holy grail when it came to COVID-19, but it's not something I think we should be trying to pursue, especially with the virus that's able to mutate and create new variants. Because maybe if we were still dealing with the Wuhan strain of COVID-19, we would be above that threshold. And indeed, we saw dramatic drops in cases with the Alpha variant when we just hit kind of 40% fully vaccinated. But the Delta variant really changed that, because it's so much more transmissible. It raises the threshold for what level of the population needs to be immune to reach herd immunity. I think the proper goal with COVID-19 is to really make sure that our high-risk people are fully vaccinated, that they're boosted, that they have access to medications and treatments, because we can't eradicate this virus. We can't eliminate this virus. Our goal is to tame it, to make it more like other respiratory viruses that we deal with on a year-in and year-out basis. And that means that we may not ever reach herd immunity, but what we'll do is have this become a much more manageable infection, one that doesn't threaten hospital capacity again, one for which we have a whole toolbox of medications, diagnostics, monoclonal antibodies, all of that to be able to make it a much easier disease to deal with in the future.
Have there been recent breakthroughs in therapeutics and other treatments for COVID-19?
Well, the biggest breakthroughs have been the antivirals that we're hearing about from both Merck and Pfizer. These are drugs that you can take orally for a five-day course that prevent you from getting serious illness and hospitalization. So they are path-breaking drugs. And I think we will likely see them maybe by the end of the year. In the best case scenario, we may see the Merck drug first before Christmas and then the Pfizer drug following. And in the UK, the Merck drug is already approved. So these are pills that you can take, just like you take Tamiflu for influenza, that could prevent you from being hospitalized or dying. That to me is a major path-breaking advance, because if you can simplify treatment and have it in home, that makes this such an easy type of virus to treat compared to what we have to do now, where we only really have monoclonal antibodies, which require infusions or injections and people having to wait for a half an hour or so after they've been given the medication to be observed, and a lot of logistics to get people to get to those products. So this is a real simplification of treatment, and it may really have a major benefit. Hopefully this comes to fruition. Hopefully we have the testing infrastructure, because there is a window of time where these drugs are most effective and you want to make sure people get them early on in their symptom course. All of that needs to be put in place. But I think that the fact that these are available or about to be available is really going to change the way we deal with COVID-19.
That was Dr. Amesh Adalja of Johns Hopkins University's Center for Health Security on Monday's Washington Journal. You can listen to the entire interview on cspan.org/Washington Journal. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey is stepping down as chief of the social media company, effective immediately. That's according to an announcement from the company. Parag Agrawal, Twitter's chief technology officer, will now take the helm. The 45-year-old Mr. Dorsey was serving as both the CEO of Twitter and Square, that's his digital payments company. He will remain a member of the board until his term expires at the 2022 meeting of stockholders. On Capitol Hill, TheHill.com reporting that Representatives Ilhan Omar, Democrat of Minnesota, and Lauren Boebert, Republican of Colorado, clashed in what both described as a tense phone call earlier. That's after a video surfaced of the far-right lawmaker making Islamophobic remarks about her colleague. The two lawmakers issued separate statements after the phone call, making it clear that neither found the conversation to be helpful in settling their differences. You can find more at TheHill.com. Moving now to the Senate chamber, where Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said he plans to pass President Biden's spending bill before Christmas. Now, this comes after the House passed the social and climate spending bill before a weeks-long Thanksgiving break. Here's Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
Now on government funding. As we all know, by the end of this week, both parties must come to an agreement for funding the government and avoiding a needless shutdown. At the end of September, Democrats and Republicans worked together to keep the government open through December 3rd, avoiding many of the fights that tainted so many funding debates under the previous administration. After the House takes action this week, the Democratic-led Senate will move forward to make sure the government remains funded after the deadline. With so many critical issues, the last thing the American people need right now is a government shutdown. And Democrats are going to work this week to make sure we don't have one this time around. It's important to get it done, and we are working to get it done. And finally, Madam President, on Build Back Better. Before the end of the year, the Senate will also act on President Biden's Build Back Better legislation, which momentously passed the House at the very end of the last work period. This week, Democrats will continue to meet with the Senate parliamentarian in order to complete the technical and procedural work required before a bill comes to the floor. Meetings were held over the Thanksgiving week, and we will continue this week and next week as needed. As I've said repeatedly, once this necessary work is completed with the parliamentarian, I will bring the President's Build Back Better legislation to the floor, so we can pass it as soon as possible and send it to the President's desk. Our goal continues to be to get this done before Christmas. Build Back Better represents the largest investment in the American people in generations. Under our bill, childcare will be more affordable, pre-K will be more affordable, and raising kids overall will be more affordable for tens of millions of parents. The bill will take unprecedented steps in the fight against the climate crisis, paving the way for even greater action in the future. And as scores of economists from across the ideological spectrum attest to, Build Back Better will not worsen inflation, and in the long run, help bring costs under control. So cutting costs, saving parents money, fighting climate change, and creating the jobs of tomorrow, these are the things the American people want, these are the things the American people need, and these are the things that Build Back Better will deliver on once we pass it through this chamber.
Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor earlier. But the Build Back Better social and climate spending bill faces hurdles in the Senate, where Democrats' 50-seat majority needs total unity, plus Vice President Kamala Harris's in the chair to break a tie in order to both start debate on the reconciliation bill and pass it. Now, Congress is only a couple of weeks away from hitting the December 15th deadline to raise the federal debt limit. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Minority Leader Mitch McConnell don't appear to be anywhere close to a deal. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Now, on a related matter, why do our Democratic colleagues want to shortchange our national defense? Well, to free up their time and attention for another massive, reckless taxing and spending spree, a radical wish list that would hurt American families and help China. Working families are already getting slammed by runaway costs because Democrats' last massive spending spree drove up inflation. Gas prices are up about 50%. Used car prices are up more than 25%, and grocery prices across practically every category are up significantly over this time last year. But in response, Washington Democrats want to print, borrow, and spend trillions more. Even if you accept all their budget gimmicks at face value, this bill alone would unleash $800 billion in not paid for spending in the next 5 years. Years 5 through 10 are when they're crushing tax hikes, and phony accounting would actually begin to kick in. But even then, the bill is not paid for. President Biden promised Americans over and over that this legislation would cost $0. Obviously, that's false. The Congressional Budget Office says that after 10 years, after their tax hikes and fake offsets are factored in, their spree would still add up to $367 billion and add that all to the deficit. President Biden said the deficit impact would be zero. In reality, it's hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. President Biden promised Americans something else, too. He said he'd never raise taxes on the middle class. People earning less than $400,000 per year were not to pay a penny more. He has completely broken this promise as well. Among the $1.5 trillion in job-killing tax increases are new burdens for small businesses, family farms, and direct hikes on middle-class families earning less than six figures. Meanwhile, amazingly, Democrats did find room in their plan to include $300 billion in tax cuts for the wealthiest blue state zip codes in New York and California. Our colleagues want to pretend they're launching another New Deal, yet one of the biggest components is a direct cash giveaway to their richest constituents. So the cost of this spending spree would be astronomical, and the massive tax hikes that would only partly pay for it would literally crush an already fragile economy.
That's Minority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking on the Senate floor earlier. For a preview of the week ahead in Congress, we talked to The Hill's congressional reporter, Christina Marcos.
So, yes, that's the top of lawmakers' to-do list this week as they start coming back into Washington from the Thanksgiving break. Absent congressional action right now, current government funding is set to run out Friday night. And so that's the first things first is lawmakers have to figure out how to avoid a shutdown. Right now, it's not yet clear how long another stopgap measure would last. In the House, the chairwoman of the House Appropriations Committee, Rosa DeLauro, is pushing for a stopgap measure that would go into mid-December or so. And she argues that's a way to keep pressure on Republicans to reach a longer-term deal on federal spending. On the other hand, there's such a long to-do list for Congress in the next few weeks, particularly in the Senate, where legislation just moves a lot more slowly than in the House. And so there's also some discussion among congressional leaders about potentially passing a stopgap measure this week that would go into January or February, just so lawmakers would have more time to negotiate a top-line spending level. So that's something that's still under discussion, but at this point there's no expectation that there would be a shutdown, but lawmakers still have to iron out the date first.
Well, your colleague Alex Bolton reporting this morning on another issue related to the spending deadline is the debt ceiling. They're raising the debt ceiling for the United States. No deal in sight as Congress nears the debt limit deadline. What will they do there?
So the two top leaders in the Senate, Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell, have been talking in recent weeks. They had a meeting shortly before the Thanksgiving break, and both sides portrayed it as a productive meeting that was constructive. But they're still not on the same page when it comes to how to raise the debt limit. Republicans are still pushing for Democrats to use the budget reconciliation process that would allow Republicans to offer unlimited amounts of amendments and try to force Democrats to take some politically tricky votes. And of course, Democrats would rather not have to go that route. So there's still a question of how to avoid a default in the next couple of weeks. But the fact that McConnell and Schumer are talking is more progress than we saw the last time around back in October, the last time that we had this debt limit fight.
As you mentioned, much of the attention this week will be focused on the U.S. Senate. They come back today. They begin by taking up the defense authorization measure. And off the floor, discussions continue on the president's social spending measure, the Build Back Better plan, it's called. First of all, to floor action, will they complete action on that defense measure, another must-pass measure by the U.S. Congress? And secondly, where do things stand on the $2 trillion measure, the Build Back Better plan?
So with the defense bill, that's actually one of the few bills that that's something that has to be passed on an annual basis to renew defense programs. And that's something that Congress has managed to renew every year consecutively for the last several decades. And so lawmakers want to be sure to keep up that track record. Senators tried to reach a deal on some amendments to vote on before passage of the bill, before the Thanksgiving break, but there were some objections among some senators who didn't get amendments. And so they're still trying to work out an agreement for how to move forward, but the Senate does plan to vote tonight on a procedural vote to advance the bill forward. So senators are hoping to pass the defense bill by the end of this week.
Back to the
and
House.
And then with the Build Back Better Act,
yes.
The House just passed it before the Thanksgiving break. So, and now every single Senate Democrat, all 50 of them, has to get on board in order to send this to President Biden's desk. And so that means that individual senators have a ton of leeway over what's in the final bill. And so there are still some lingering issues to iron out, including paid family leave, as well as the state and local tax deduction.
One more thing. Over the weekend, you wrote about looking ahead to 2022. The headline on your piece on Saturday said GOP eyes booting Democrats from seats if the House flips. What is this, a retaliatory measure by Republicans?
It would be if they take over the House. Shortly before the Thanksgiving break, the House voted to both censure and take away committee assignments from Paul Gosar after he posted an anime video that depicted him killing Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, as well as swinging swords at President Biden. And so Democrats have maintained, both in the case of Paul Gosar and earlier this year when they removed Marjorie Taylor Greene from committees, that they're establishing a precedent of not tolerating lawmakers who appear to promote political violence. And they say that's a red line, particularly after the violent attack on the Capitol on January 6th. But Republicans are very frustrated at being in the House minority, where that means they don't have a whole lot of ability to stop whatever the majority wants to do. And so Republicans who are very frustrated about this have been pushing Kevin McCarthy to take retaliatory action in the event they do take over the House in 2022.
Christina Marcos from Monday's Washington Journal. Find more on cspan.org/Washington Journal. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Fumio Kishida has renewed his pledge to consider, quote, all options, including acquiring enemy base strike capability to protect the country amid growing threats from China and North Korea. Al Jazeera reporting that Prime Minister Kishida said at his first troop review on Saturday that the security situation in the region is rapidly changing and that, quote, the reality is severer than ever, with North Korea continuing to test fire ballistic missiles while advancing its capability, and China pursuing a military buildup and increasingly assertive activity in the region. Here in Washington, D.C., the Center for Strategic and International Studies, several professors in Asian studies discussed the results of a multi-year study on previous U.S. strategies to denuclearize North Korea. Seon-ho Shin, associate professor at Seoul National University Graduate School of International Studies, said that President Obama's approach was one of strategic patience, while President Trump's approach gave North Korean leader Kim Jong-un legitimacy on the world stage. Here's Professor Seon-ho Shin.
In recently, especially in this giving South Korea's ongoing presidential campaign, there is an interesting debate coming out within South Korea, saying that, can we really trust U.S. extended deterrence against this increasing North Korea's nuclear capability? And one of the extreme, you know, kind of a wild case scenario among some of those Korean politicians, for example, is that maybe we, South Korea need to develop our own nuclear capability. I think that's a kind of very dangerous kind of area that, you know, we could fall into if we emphasize too much about a kind of capability. We overestimate North Korea's nuclear capability or intention. So this is a kind of my second work, trying to, you know, to assess how to strike a balance between North Korea's rhetoric and their nuclear intention and their real capability. That's kind of what I've been working on. But I guess going back to your first question, I guess Biden administration, you know, came up with kind of a pragmatic and calibrated approach to North Korea, what that is, how to deal with North Korea. I think eventually they have to find some way in between Obama and Trump's approach. But bottom line is they need to talk to Kim Jong-un again.
That's Seon-ho Shin, associate professor at Seoul National University Graduate School of International Studies. And speaking of diplomacy, the Atlantic Council hosted a discussion with former diplomats on ways to reinvigorate U.S. foreign policy. Deborah McCarthy is a former U.S. ambassador to Lithuania in the Obama administration. She said U.S. diplomats are working on critical U.S. interests, yet the State Department is understaffed and underfunded.
We need, however, substantial new language on training, stronger requirements for diversity, and if possible, the real application of the criteria for qualification of ambassadors and other political appointees in the department. A third factor required, in my view, for reinvigorating diplomacy is upping the game on strategic communication, both abroad and within the United States. The Atlantic Council has issued an excellent report that I recommend to everybody on upgrading U.S. public diplomacy. Let me start with domestic messaging. U.S. diplomacy needs a much broader constituency, both in Congress and in the general public. On the Hill, the current diplomacy / foreign service caucuses need to be expanded to include members who have a background in national security or are interested in diplomacy, and yet who may not serve in certain key committees. Secondly, the department needs to have more people focused on the relationships with the Hill. Within the general public, to build general support, it means vastly expanding the work of such entities as the department's Office of Public Liaison to engage with new audiences, not those who already know and understand foreign affairs, such as World Councils, though they have been great supporters. Overseas on messaging, it means truly having a strategic plan adaptable to regions and countries and integrating data. And on this element, I want to note a critical aspect of a strategic plan is an enhanced effort to fight disinformation.
That's Deborah McCarthy, former U.S. ambassador to Lithuania in the Obama administration, speaking at the Atlantic Council earlier. And the holiday decorations were unveiled today for President Joe Biden and First Lady Dr. Jill Biden as their first White House Christmas honors frontline workers who persevered during the COVID-19 pandemic. Nurses, doctors, teachers, grocery store workers, and others are recognized in this year's gigantic gingerbread White House, which was made into a 350-pound gingerbread village with the addition of a school and police, fire and gas stations, as well as a hospital, a post office, a grocery store, and a warehouse to honor workers who stayed on the job. You can find the holiday decorations and displays on cspan.org. And now a reminder that all of our coverage is online anytime at cspan.org. And if you missed any of this program, you can find it at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington, delivered daily right to your inbox, you can subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. Thanks for listening today to Washington Today.